Buddhist Summer School, Tuesday afternoon, 28th of August, 1984. Venerable sirs and venerable lady, the practice of the fiercest austerity taught Siddhartha Gautama its utter fruitlessness. He then recalled his childhood experience of the first jhana as he sat peacefully in the cool shade of a rose apple tree whilst his royal father, together with his counselors and people, performed the annual ploughing ceremony. Recalling this, he wondered, now, could this be a way to awakening? Then, following on mindfulness, there was the consciousness, the true insight. This is itself the way to awakening. And he saw that he was not afraid of the happiness which is apart from the happiness of sense pleasures, apart from unskilled states of mind. This comes in the Mahasatchaka Sutta. This business of not being afraid of this happiness. He had experienced the happiness of sense pleasures long before. And he had seen that they are always followed by depression and a miserable state, more or less, the longing for the repetition of the pleasures which cannot be fulfilled and so forth. But in the case of the jhanas, there was a pleasure which did not upset his mental balance at all. And it was a happiness, therefore, which produced no fear, no anxiety, no future longing, further longing. Prior to his practice of the austerities, in company with the five, Kondanya, Vappa, Bhaddiya, Mahanama and Asaji, he had gone to Alarakalama the Brahman, who taught him how to enter the various jhanas and samapattis up to the plane of no thing. Akinchanyayatana. But Gautama reflects that this Dhamma, the entry into this state of consciousness, is not the culminating point of full awakening, for it does not conduce to complete disenchantment, nibbida, desirelessness, virago, stopping of skandha limitations, nirodha, calm, upasama, super-knowledge, abhinya. These super-knowledges were clairvoyance and clairaudience, recalling the jatis, the certainty of realized freedom, etc. Awakening, sambodhi, and to nibbana. So, he leaves Alara and goes to Uddaka Ramaputta, another Brahman, who takes him on to one more stage, the plane of neither perception nor non-perception. Neva sanya nasanyayatana, which is the summit of becoming. But even this is not the fading away of bhav-asava, the passion for becoming this, that or the other, greater or better. On returning from these deep states of consciousness to the ordinary state, one is still subject, even if in minor degree, to desire, attachment, and aversion, all of which characterize isolative and separative self-consciousness. So he leaves Ramaputta and goes to Uruvela, where the five, Kondanya, Vappa, Badya, Mahanama and Asaji, were practicing ghastly austerities which were supposed to culminate in the perfect awakening. It took him 6 years to discover their futility. The practice of austerities was in vogue for probably 3 or 4 millennia before the Buddha's days. This was while the undivided Aryan-speaking peoples, the Indian group and the what later on became the Iranian group, were flourishing in the Ukraine and somewhere around the Caspian region and so forth. It was believed that such practices were even more effective than the Vedic ritual sacrifices to compel the gods to take possession of them, lift them to the highest spiritual heights and bestow extraordinary spiritual powers. They believed in magic. The correctly intoned chanting of the magical spells at the ritual sacrifice was supposed to produce the desired result. 3,500 years ago, Zarathustra taught that Ahura Mazda, God, created the universe by means of the Ahuna Vairya, the creative word, the supreme magical spell. Judaism and Christianity have their belief in the creative power of the word. The Ma'amar of the Hebrews and the word of St. John. St. John identifies the word with God, the Creator. Gautama saw that personal, separative desire was involved in all these ritual sacrifices and austerities. Gautama well understood the true meaning of desire. This English word, derived from desiderare, means to turn away from the light. De, away from, and siderare from sidus. Sider is a star, which is a self-shining light. So desire essentially means a turning away from the light. Gautama's supreme aspiration, not desire. With desire, there is grasping for oneself. With true aspiration, there is a total giving of oneself, a total surrender of oneself to that to which you aspire. So, Gautama's supreme aspiration was for the light of wisdom, as he told Mara's darling daughters on the fateful night. In his teaching, therefore, Gautama dismissed the superstitious belief that sacrificial rituals and austerities had anything to do with enlightenment and liberation. Having once again taken food and recovered health and strength, and possessing himself of a practical, sane outlook, he sat in meditation that fateful night of the Vesak full moon. I doubt very much whether he experienced temptations and the fury of Mara, of which we spoke the other day, and his demon host. For Gautama, most surely, was already a purified man, living a saintly life, incorruptible. I am certain that he entered the 4 jhanas and the 4 samapatis and entered that 9th state, the cessation, which is the supreme meditative state possible to humankind. That state can be entered only by one's own effort. No one else can take you into it. You have a similar sort of teaching in the Kabbalistic teachings. When you go through what they call the abyss to the final state of Ein Sof. You are absolutely alone in the same sense that transcendence is the absolute alone. An aloneness which, by virtue of its unitary wholeness, is the one total reality. It is this which enabled Gautama to realize and affirm the Samma Sambodhi. In this all-enlightened state, he was already conscious of the entire teaching which it was his task first to translate and then to present in the concepts and words available in his day and most suitable for his people. We must bear well in mind that the Buddha repeats in discourse after discourse all the jhanas and samapatis. He simply gives a list of them with very few words to suggest what they might mean. Why does he do so? I feel that these jhanas and samapatis do constitute the real mysterium tremendum of Buddhism. Let us note carefully that he himself calls the first two samapatis the infinity of akasha, akasanam chayatanam, and of vijnana, vijnanam chayatanam. Akasha means space, sky, atmosphere, speaking colloquially. Philosophically, it is the subtle, ethereal fluid supposed to fill and pervade the universe and to be the peculiar vehicle of life and sound. Briefly, the visible and the invisible cosmos. Vijnana is consciousness and is associated with time. The infinity of vijnana is eternity and immortality. Eternity and immortality are in fact interchangeable terms. In infinity and eternity, nothing begins, proceeds, and ends. No birth, no death. To our limited vijnanic consciousness, everything begins and proceeds and ends. Only the transmuted vijnana, namely vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabam, consciousness which is characterless, unending, therefore without beginning, everywhere shining, can be conscious in terms of infinity and eternity whilst bodily alive. Because Gautama was entirely purified by equanimity and perfect attentiveness, he realized in clear consciousness that the transcendent context is the infinite eternal. I'm talking about this because you may recall yesterday I ended with the statement that it was left to Gautama the Buddha to give the broad hint of the nature of the context of the supreme state. Do not regard a samapatti as an attainment, that is, I think, the usual dictionary meaning, but regard it as a coalescence in consciousness with the universal, the transcendent. The third and fourth samapattis are the entry into the planes of no thing and of neither perception nor non-perception. Any thing is a finite, temporal, mortal, and separate entity, not the unitary whole, not the nondescript infinite or eternal. It can be known in our ordinary vijnanic consciousness, our unawakened state, by perception, or it can be experienced by feeling. In the state of infinity and eternity, and through the four samapattis, there is a realization of the void, which inevitably leads to the cessation, granted one's spiritual stamina and stability to go that far, and that ninth state, which is devoid of all perception and feeling, and which is the realization of the unborn, unaging, undying, unsorrowing, unstained. The terms perception and feeling with respect to these transcendent states of consciousness must not be understood in the ordinary meanings of the words perception and feeling. If any of you have ever had that extraordinary experience of inward quietude, so deep, so profound, that the brain actually does stop talking, then you will have perceptions and feelings of a transcendental nature, which makes you aware without the use of concepts and words. And it is that, even that, comes to an end in the ninth state. This realization is in pure mind and in transcendent consciousness, the unitarily whole consciousness. It is void of all concepts and words, void of the slightest trace of ill. It is Nibbana. And remember, the first literal meaning of Nibbana is the complete extinction of all greed, hate, delusion, and all that is associated with those three terms. And to this half, the other moiety of seeing by unerring insight the destruction of the cankers, the asavas of karma, bhava, avijja, and ditthi, of lust, of becoming, of ignorance, and speculation. I understand asavas, that is to say, I prefer to regard asavas in their literal meaning as overflows. Overflows of consciousness out of a pure and transcendent state into consciousness of sense pleasures, becoming, ignorance, and wrong speculative views. I specifically use the adjective wrong because, after all, any statement that is made in words and in terms of concepts and so forth can always be called a speculative view. One has to test it out, find out whether it does represent the truth. And I like to think of asavas as overflows for this reason. You know, asava, for instance, if you dig your knife into a palm tree, you'll get an exudation. Now, it is something like that. The knife which is dug into the state of consciousness where everything is pure and complete is some sort of stimulus which comes either through the uprising of some memory or through some immediate external stimulus. So that is the knife which is stuck in, and consciousness overflows into karma, bhava, avijja, and ditthi. The entry into the cessation and the destruction of the cankers is the ultimate spiritual freedom for a human being. It is the state of the arhat who is now the supremely self-enlightened Sambuddha. There you have perhaps the best statement of the purpose of our existence. Why are we here? In order that transcendence itself may realize its own transcendence, its own perfection through us realizing this. I don't attain anything. The I is completely out. There is nothing whatsoever for me. And the sooner I realize that, the better. Not only for me, but for everybody else around me. It is because people seek for themselves that they create discord, conflict, confusion, trouble, misery, and the whole host. Thus we can see that the Buddha's awakening to the infinite eternal was his discovery of the true meaning of the deathless. Because in that state, consciousness, that transcendent consciousness undergoes no change. It is immutable. This deathless is that which never ages, falls ill, or dies. Aging, sickening, and dying belong to the psychophysical organism, which is the Nama Rupa, the five khandhas, which are characterized by anicca, impermanence as it is translated, dukkha, whose meaning is, first meaning is badness. You will find this in the Visuddhimagga, Nyanamoli's translation, page 563, and by anatta. We cognize this through vijnana, discriminative consciousness, which perishes with death. But when vijnana is transmuted into vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabam, there is the cessation of separative perception. There is only eternal being. For you are at one in mind and consciousness with that which was previously perceived as a separate object. With the transmutation of personal vijnana, there is only the unitarily whole being of the unborn, unbecome, unmade, uncompounded. The words I, you, he, she, this, that, or the other all become meaningless and do not apply in the context of the infinite eternal, the deathless. Do remember that this does not destroy your ordinary discriminative consciousness in the ordinary everyday life. It purifies it altogether, and it in fact makes you far more sensitive than ever. In the worldly manner. The jhanas and samapattis must not be seen as rungs of a ladder. They are varying intensities of the enlightening of consciousness. Just as if you have a bulb which can stand a very, very high voltage, at a low voltage it will give a little light, increase the voltage and the light will become brighter and brighter. The passage through the jhanas and samapattis is like that. It is not like climbing a ladder. Every ladder will fall down. Vijnana reaches its climax at the fourth jhana. Note what the Buddha says in connection with this. The fourth jhana has neither sukha nor dukkha, neither joy nor sorrow. It is entirely purified by equanimity and mindfulness. And this state of equanimity is actually the real source of the emergence of transcendent love, of the true Mahakaruna and Metta. Then, by passing quite beyond perception of material shapes, by the going down of perception of sensory reactions, by not attending to perception of variety, by being aware that akasha is unending, he enters upon and abides in the plane of infinite Akasha. And similarly for Vijnana. But infinite consciousness is characterless, anidasana. Characteristics are present only in the world of countless separate things. Because without differentiated separateness, no characteristics, that is, separate distinguishing marks or qualities, can be discerned. You must have difference and separateness in order to compare and measure and weigh and so on, in order to represent characteristics. But where consciousness is total, all-pervading, the characteristics are there for the consciousness which is not at that transcendent level. They are there. And of course the perfected Holy One can function both ways easily. Thus the entry into infinity means the transmutation of worldly discriminative consciousness into transcendent consciousness. This kind of transmutation of consciousness occurred with all the great spiritual founders of religions. This transmutation was the supreme spiritual source of their extraordinary power and energy, which enabled their teachings to live, to outlive their day and age, and to survive for thousands of years. You see, if you take the teachings of the great teachers, I mean, an ordinary person could think such things out and state them. After all, look at the teachings as they stand. An ordinary person can do it. But when the perfected Holy One does it, what he says goes out with such an extraordinary invisible power that it lasts for centuries. In the cessation, this infinite consciousness is entirely free of every vestige of selfness, separativeness, and isolativeness. It is divine omniscience, wherein knowing is identical with being and doing. Such doing is the creative action in eternity of the primordial creative energy, which gives rise to differentiation and the whole evolutionary process of the emergence and formation of the cosmos is set in motion. This transcendent creative action in eternity is the root karma, the original primordial karma, creative act. The root of the word karma, kri, for me, really means to create, not just the dictionary meaning to make or to do, but it means to create. It is not caused by anything. Being transcendent, it is free of consequence. It has neither origin nor cessation, neither qualities nor properties. Far, very, very far down the line, karma is seen as cause and effect because bondage has come into being. The absolute freedom and indeterminism of the primordial creative action has given place to determinism and loss of freedom. Not altogether, for that eternal creative action always remains as a healing power, a redeeming power, and ultimately it alone remains the transcendent nirvana, of which our possible nirvana is but a foreshadowing. This creative action is utterly immaculate, virginal source of the totality, womb of the cosmos, which is the sun of necessity. This primordial karma holds within itself the original Vedic Rita, the Zarathustrian Asha, the Dharma, which is the absolute order, law, justice, righteousness and truth inherent in the cosmic wholeness. That is to say, the nature of that primordial karma when experienced at our level of development, is expressed by us as order, justice, righteousness, and truth, all of which are contained in the single word asha, or rita, or dharma. Pure consciousness, functioning in the context of the infinite eternal, wholly negates the vijnanic consciousness of the finite temporal context without destroying it. Pure consciousness knows no distance, boundary, measurement, expansion, compression. No time, duration, birth, growth, death. No separation, no otherness. No success, failure, fulfillment. No good or evil in our sense of these words. It is the context of absolute isness, Ishtikkeit of Eckhart. Primordial creative energy is pure consciousness, is pure will devoid of desire, which, as said earlier, fundamentally means to turn away from a star, a self-shining light. Any and every desire is a turning away from the pure light, the all-enlightened pure consciousness of transcendence. Unhappily, and happily from our point of view, a turning away from the light did take place. There is a fascinating statement in his Zarathustrian scripture in Yasna 19, verse 15. It runs thus: the most excellent Ahura Mazda proclaimed the Ahuna Vairya, the creative word. The most excellent, the eternal, caused it to be repeated after him. Owing to a pause in the repetition, evil originated. It's rather a wonderful statement. You see, the absolute, pure, the perfect, eternal God, and that is as far as they could go in 3,500 years ago, speaks the word of power, wields this creative energy, called Kshatravairya in Avastan, wields this creative energy and brings forth a universe which is utterly good, utterly pure. Which means that creative activity is permanent, continuous. Otherwise eternity and infinity would have no meaning. That primordial karma, that primordial creative act is continuous as such. Well, continuous is a bad word, to tell you the truth, because it implies space and time and all the rest of it. But I can't find any word in the language to express this. Now, when there was a pause, there was a cessation of that creative action, of that divine creative action. And therefore, that was the moment when something could go wrong. And so, owing to the pause, evil originated. This is a rather wonderful idea. But Ahura Mazda pronounced the divine interdict that in no form whatsoever, in thought, word, deed, creed, etc., could there be any agreement with the wicked one. Zarathustra, being the earliest uncompromising monotheist, naturally presents evil as a being, the wicked one. Creation by creative energy or creative power means the maintenance of perpetual light. A pause in creative action in eternity means the absence of light. And in the transcendent context, that means that darkness is also infinite. But it is not eternal, for it had a birth in that pause which originated evil. And since it had birth, time, a limiting dimension involving ending, came into being, together with a limiting mode of consciousness which introduced duration and succession, procedure and process, and hence death. Therefore, evil must of necessity undergo death and no rebirth except through our own ignorance, stupidity and evil doing, which could spawn another cosmic evil. All this is the unhappy part. And you see, the living of the good life necessitates a ceaseless living goodness. Let that stop at any moment, and that's where the devil will get you. That is why I always say, I myself am the devil, just as much as I myself have the divine potentiality. Because when your mindfulness, your attentiveness loses its grip on that which is the perfect and the holy, then the unholy steps in. Thus was duality born. But happily, duality was and is indispensable for our existence and the existence of the entire cosmos. Our existence as members of the human species is invaluable. We, constituted as we are through our evolution from the primates, have the potentiality within us to free ourselves from the shackles of evil, from all dukkha, by realizing Buddhahood. Thereby we redeem all the world by healing it of its unholy state, afflicted as it is by evil. The healing is the important thing. You know how when we are faced with problems, difficulties, illnesses and whatnot, we seek palliatives or something which counteracts. Palliatives and counteractions are no use. Thing has to be healed, made whole. That which is ill is part and parcel of an eternal reality. Only it is that part of the eternal which has misexpressed itself. It's gone out of hand. We've got to bring it back again. You see, redemption has to be for the totality, not just for for some of the baddies who can be redeemed, and there are some who never can be redeemed. Existence is, its literal meaning is a standing out of the absolute, ex sistere, to stand out of. What do you stand out of? The total reality. The eternal holy. You stand out of that. What that standing out of the unitary whole is our fundamental dukkha, the true meaning of our being born in and continuing to be in a state of sin. The Roman Catholics are quite right in saying that we are born in sin, but only partly so, and therefore only misleadingly right. For in their miserable anxiety to insist upon the indispensability of a parthenogenetically born external Redeemer and Savior, they have forgotten, or perhaps deliberately and therefore sinfully, left out or suppressed the simple fact that all of us and all creatures and things are the children born of immaculate conception. For who is each and every one of us? Each of us is indeed transcendence embodied, not other than the primordial creative energy and its whole context of eternity and infinity, totally incarnate in each of us. Also in the smallest infinity, the point, and in that immeasurably great unity, infinity, the cosmos. In that marvelously significant little creature, the living cell, and in the mighty manifestation of supreme perfection, the fully self-enlightened Buddha. Do you think the Buddha himself was unaware of this? I would affirm unequivocally that he was fully conscious of it, though not in the above form of English words, presenting concepts and words born of a scientific age. Had he not been conscious of it, he could never have said to Upaka, whom he met on the road from Uruvela to Isipatana. He said, "Victorious over all, omniscient am I, among all things undefiled, leaving all through death of craving freed, by knowing for myself, whom should I point to? For me there is no teacher. One like me does not exist. In the world with its devas, no one equals me. For I am perfected in the world. A teacher supreme am I. I alone am all awakened. Become cool am I. Nibbana attained. To turn the Dhamma wheel, I go to Kasi's city, beating the drum of deathlessness in a world that's blind become." Imagine an Englishman who is become the fully enlightened one saying that to English people. What would the people say? What a conceited idiot. The words as they stand are really terrific. They are terrible, terror-provoking. Is this sort of thing a possibility? Well, of course it is. Siddhartha Gautama did it. And in his lifetime he claimed that his arahants also did it. So what? In the Isigili Sutta, I think it's in the third volume of the Majjhima, I forget the exact indication. In the Isigili Sutta, the Buddha recounts the names of over 100 who had realized Buddhahood. It is out of the profundity of a transcendent consciousness that the perfected Holy One presents teachings in the worldly context of vijnana, the discriminative consciousness. A few moments ago, I said that the transcendent context negates the worldly context, but does not destroy it. In actual fact, there is only one context, namely the context of the unitarily whole, one total reality. But because we have not yet developed beyond the subhuman stage, our insufficiently evolved consciousness is awake in the finite temporal mortal context only. And in this context, it is impossible to talk in unitary terms, in terms which are altogether unitary. There are no words. That is why one is compelled to talk in terms of this context and that context. But actually, it is one total reality, one unitary whole. And I feel very strongly that the evolutionary process is moving man towards this transformation of his vijnanic consciousness into the unitarily whole consciousness. That is perhaps a very real meaning of omniscience. Not that you know everything in the sense that an encyclopedia contains a lot of information. Information is out. Whatsoever you want to know, you know at once. The Buddha himself says time and again how like a strong man who can put out his arm or flex his muscle, so immediately he is in another region, in the realm of the 33 or whatever it is. We would say magic. But this is just a simple fact of a transcendent consciousness. That is all. When our consciousness has reached its culminating point, we shall see that the worldly context is the transcendent context minus several of its dimensions. Hence, where there is intellectual clear-sightedness, the absence of illusions and delusions, and of all self-orientedness, and a completely purified psyche, it is possible to express the truth realized in transcendent consciousness in the limited forms available in worldly vijnanic terms. Forms which are least inadequate and misleading and are suitable for the people living under the restrictions of their own times, their culture, their traditions, and their personal development psychologically, intellectually, and spiritually. After the Enlightenment, the Buddha had to solve this very difficult problem of how to present this transcendent truth to the people. During the 7 weeks he stayed at Uruvela after the Enlightenment, he spent the first week realizing the bliss of Nibbana. The second in steadfast gazing at the root of the tree of enlightenment. What is that tree? He was not a botanist or interested in botany. That tree is just this. The brain and the spinal cord, right, with all its chakras and so forth. The third, in pacing to and fro from the throne beneath the wisdom tree to the place of the steadfast gazing. The fourth, in developing the right formulation of the doctrine. The fifth, in sitting beneath the tree of Sujata's offering, meditating on the teaching. It's a come-and-see teaching, it's not a laid-down doctrine. And the sweetness of Nibbana. During the sixth, a terrible storm raged when the snake king, Muchalinda, sheltered him with his sevenfold hood. The seventh, beneath the Rajayatana tree, enjoying the sweetness of liberation. You know how the world, as generally speaking, thinks that to be religious means to be thoroughly miserable. The world has never even attempted to live religiously. It pretends to do so in a large measure, and it imagines it does so in a still larger measure. But it never really lives religiously. If it lived religiously, it would know what true happiness is, what true peace of mind is, and so forth. The nature and meaning of this bliss and sweetness for the perfected Holy One has no relationship to the nature and meaning for the ordinary mortal. Just as sugar is necessary for the brain, bliss is a power for spiritual well-being in the transcendent context. It radiates peace and compassion from the Holy One to the world at large. Unlike the sought and organized death-dealing pleasure and happiness of the worldling, bliss is the natural state of the Holy One. It is both his health and beauty, and his elixir of life and promise of freedom, for suffering mortals. With his mind rooted in purity and perfection, wisdom and bliss, the Buddha evolved and propounded the formulation of the Eightfold Way during those 7 weeks. Although called eightfold, the eight limbs of the way constitute a single whole, for each limb affects all the others. If anyone is faulty, the whole of the way suffers faultiness. A teacher can help by suggestions, explanations, putting his finger on the root mistake, by advice, patience, and so on. But the true understanding and correction comes only from one's own inner depths. The Buddha himself explained why one man succeeds and another fails by saying, "It is due to a difference in their faculties. After all, only a lion can roar and a mouse can only squeak." At the same time, we must remember that it is the mouse who can gnaw away the hunter's net and set free the lion caught in it. Never does a mouse crave to be the king of beasts. The point about this statement is to suggest that we should be free of ambition, especially spiritual ambition. If we refrain from comparing ourselves with others, we shall be free from all jealousy and envy, and also the misery of proud conceit in relation to the less fortunate or advanced. We succeed because of self-conceit and desire. I'm using the word succeed in the worldly sense. We succeed in the world because of self-conceit and desire. We fail because of self-esteem and unfulfilled desire. If we are free of these impostors, we shall dwell content, and in peace we shall walk happily on the way, our own way, for each person's brahmacharya is special to him because each person is unique. There is no one else in the world who is exactly like him.